Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast, episode 243. It's the fifth week.
Yep.
Of the first month.
Right, that means it's weirdo time.
It is weird. It's a weird week. It's also
does that mean it's going to be another weird podcast?
Maybe, possibly.
When is it not a weird podcast?
No, like, sometimes it's kind of a little wacky, but then sometimes it's like Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol.
Yeah.
I remember the days of Willow podcast.
Podcast? Willow, the 80s Willow.
Yeah.
We had a whole, like, section dedicated to...
Remember we had it thematically?
No. See, Randy doesn't even remember this,
I feel like it was last year.
Yeah, it was, like a month ago.
Willow and Mad Mardigan and stuff like that.
His brain clicks.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of there's Willow from Buffy.
No, I know exactly which Willow you're talking about.
Oh, you're just dum-dum.
Yeah, just dum-dum. Yeah, when you say Willow, my mind immediately goes to the 80s Willow that Ron Howard did.
I tried to give you an out.
No. I mean, Allison Hannigan, that's a good Willow too.
Yeah. Look, I'm old. My memory doesn't work anymore. Who are you? What am I doing here?
What's a podcast?
Why is toast burning?
Why do I smell burning feathers?
It is also a weird week in that Diamond decided to play a prank on us, and we're missing a bunch of comics.
Yeah.
With any luck, we'll have them on Thursday, but we do have a few missing gaps, which means... I don't think it deeply affected the podcast. Like, we still got to read just about everything.
Yeah, most of the stuff that I think we wanted to read, we got in just by luck.
Of note is that the Age of X-Men, the new, like, X-Men crossover, we will not have on the shelf, pretty much. But it should be here on Thursday.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. So, store news. Next Monday, we'll begin the inventory sale. We've pulled everything comics except for the indies, and we haven't gone through the board games yet. But it looks like some decent stuff, as always.
Yeah.
You'll come in, you get a discount, you roll dice, it's all super fun. If you're a member, you get the bonus discount at its maximum. So, we've been doing it every year by now. If you've never come in for it, we definitely recommend it. It's a good way to get some really good stuff for really cheap prices.
We're currently surrounded by many boxes filled with many things.
Yes, true. We cannot move because there's boxes of delights.
It's true.
Coming up on Sunday, February 10th from 3 to 6, Kate will be running her Final Fantasy card game. Coming up on Saturday, February 16th, we'll be doing a draft tournament for Magic Allegiance Weekend, and there'll be prizes and stuff like that. On to the news, which is also weird news.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this is the least weird news? This is the least weird news.
Okay.
Sandra Bullock is going to be in Mark Miller's Reborn for Netflix.
I didn't see that one.
The least weird news.
Did it announce that she's actually going to star, or is she producing?
I thought she was going to star. Am I wrong?
I thought she was producing.
Okay, it says Sandra Bullock reteams with, I see. Produce. Never mind. That's not interesting anymore.
I mean,
who's she reteaming with?
Netflix, because she
was... Yeah, she did that whole Bird Box.
Right, so which one is Reborn again?
Reborn is...
An elderly woman dies in the Manhattan Hospital, reborn in the afterlife world of Adastria, where good and evil are waging an eternal war amid dragons. She then sets off on a quest to find her late husband. And Sandra Bullock would have been great for that.
And she might very well star in it, honestly.
Yeah.
Did you say an elderly woman?
No, she's elderly in the real world, but when she goes to the afterlife, she's like young hottie.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, I can see that. I guess this is the first thing we're hearing from the whole Millar Netflix thing, though. This is like the first...
Well, I mean, no, because Magic Order is already in development.
Is it already, like, shooting and stuff?
Well, no, but this isn't shooting yet either.
Right.
This is just another... It sounds like another... they've got... Chris McKay has signed on to direct the adaptation. I don't know who that is. I don't know. I got nothing. It's a bunch of producing news. I thought it was news that she was in it.
I only like to comment on shows about assassins.
I thought you hated the assassins this year.
I changed my mind. I'm now super into assassins.
Dave's all about assassins.
Mark Millar's got at least two or three books that are themed about that.
Other news that I thought was exciting news, but it's just producing news. Nicolas Cage is going to be in Color Out of Space, which is an H.P. Lovecraft story about a family that moves to a remote farmstead in New England, and a meteorite crushes their front yard, resulting in space and time being all weird.
Yep.
That's not... That was interesting enough. But
you're hoping he would star in it, and it would be bonkers?
He is starring in it.
Okay.
And it is going to be bonkers. It's being done by Elijah Wood's Spectrevision, who are the guys who did Mandy with him.
Okay.
But I thought it was going to be like the director of Mandy, and it was like going to be that bonkers.
Yeah.
And it is not. The director is a South African filmmaker named Richard Stanley, who's directing his first feature in more than 20 years.
I don't know if he has directed anything I would recognize,
yeah.
But I will say that it's been a while since I've read, was it Colorado Space is
yep.
the one?
Yep.
It's been a while since I've read that, but like a lot of Lovecraft stories, it's a little bit dusty and nuanced and, you know, dry. It is not a Nicolas Cage type role. I don't think
he's gonna totally Nicolas Cage it.
I'm sure he will. Or even if he, like, the early half of Mandy was actually very subdued. And, you know, very deliberately so. And he can actually play quieter roles. I can't imagine...
At one point, Nicolas Cage won an Oscar.
Yep.
He can act.
Yep. I can't... I don't know what they're thinking with this movie. It's hard enough to get Lovecraft movies made, and if they're, like, gonna, like, make a bonkers Nick Cage one, that doesn't seem like a good thing for their future.
What was the last Lovecraftian movie?
Spectrevision.
There's only like Lovecraft-like movies, like Mouth of Madness and stuff.
I think Spectrevision is trying to become like a Blumhouse type thing.
Yeah.
Daniel Noah, I guess, is one of the guys there. And there's a quote here that says, "Lovecraft is the dark father of modern horror, and we've been searching for an adaptation that captures the true scope of his cosmic dread for years. Richard Stanley, a wizard in his own right, will at long last bring Lovecraft's humbling power to the screen unfiltered." I don't know if he means racism, but it doesn't sound like he's thinking bonkers adaptation.
Okay.
Stanley's credits include Hardware and Dust Devil, and notably, he was the initial director on 1996's Island of Dr. Moreau, but then was replaced by John Frankenheimer. Island of Dr. Moreau was notoriously a complete clusterfuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I don't give this much a chance.
You don't give it much of a chance of being good, or you don't think it's going to get
made? I don't give it
much
of a chance of being good.
Oh, okay.
It'll probably get made.
It'll get made. I kind of am surprised that more people haven't tried to adapt Lovecraft's stuff.
His stuff is not... I'm not going to say it's cerebral, but it's a very kind of... It was almost like a modern gothic kind of thing. It's not... It doesn't have, like... There are occasional ones with sort of energetic pacing in it, you know, the...
No, you're not... Yeah, I agree.
Was it Shadow Over Innsmouth has, ends with, like, Navy SEAL divers bombing the reefs where the deep ones live and stuff like that, and The Call of Cthulhu has a ship ramming Cthulhu outside of Relia where he manifests. So there's action, but a lot of them are kind of dry stories about people going and looking up things and finding out scary things in files and...
What's the one that Del Toro... wanted to make, and
he wanted to make the Mountains of Madness, I think, is what it is.
Dave, do you think anyone could do Cthulhu justice in film? Do you think it's filmable?
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Oh, okay. I think the guy who did Hereditary should do one.
I could see that. That would work. I think of movies like, if anybody's ever seen Darren Aronofsky's Pi,
yeah.
As tonally closer to it. You know that paranoid tone of Pi?
Yeah.
I feel like that more than anybody, like, whether the special effects can create one of the creatures or something of Lovecraft, is what I'd be more interested in. You seem unconvinced, Nick.
No, I'm just kind of sitting here kind of a little surprised, because Lovecraft is so well-beloved by a generation, it seems. I mean, or at least his work.
But I think his work does resist it. His work does not, like, have big... plot hooks. There are not character arcs that we tend to think of,
right. Or great main characters, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. They are more memorable for their ideas and for kind of their existential terror and stuff. But yeah, they would have to be somewhat, I think, heavily rewritten for film.
Yeah. I'm just challenging Hollywood now to make a shared universe Lovecraft.
Probably be a dark universe, yeah. But it could be done, maybe.
Like Fast and the Furious, but with elder gods?
Yes, of course. Well, they did make that game not too long ago. The Fast and... I can never say it.
Yeah.
I can't pronounce it. It's probably good. I'll probably summon something.
The Fatayan.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
All right, other weird thing. There's a Birds of Prey teaser, which looks, as Dave said, like it was filmed in a garage.
Yeah.
It is a... For a major production from DC Comics... It looks like a fan trailer.
So here's the thing about that. And I know, Nick, I think you kind of enjoyed it. Or,
yeah.
Or sorry.
I have a theory about it, too.
I have heard everybody... Well, two things. First, I've heard everybody talking about it, so it did manage to get talked about, and people dug around to these split-second flashes of characters have all been isolated on websites and people so people can identify them. I forgot what my second thing was. I was going to quick ask, though, before we go on, the Birds of Prey movie is about what?
Birds of Prey will see Harley Quinn, Margot Robbie, Black Canary, Journey Smollett-Bell, Huntress, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and Renee Montoya, Rosie Perez, joining forces as they try to rescue Cassandra Cain, Ella J. Basco, from Black Mask, Ewan McGregor. That was just me, that was just off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's a good guess. I liked how you parentheticaled all
yes,
that stuff.
Yes.
So, in other words, nothing to do with the Birds of Prey comic book other than it has women.
It seems like basically Harley Quinn is going to put together a squad.
Okay.
Which is weird.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't necessarily think that's a terrible movie. I think, you know, that it could be done. Like, there's a hypothetical way that works. But it is weird for me. I mean, like, an Oracle, Black Canary, and their female agents and stuff like that, I think would have been a cooler hook, the actual premise of Birds of Prey.
There's no Oracle. That's the weird thing. There's no Oracle.
Yeah.
Is, like, Renee Montoya going to put them together?
Rosie Perez is the elder statesman.
It's weird. And I also, I like this cast, but I...
Mary Elizabeth Winstead is super cool.
Yeah, I like Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
From what I understand, I don't think... The first thing I saw on this online, and it could be just this was a guess that somebody did, that the studio didn't put this up, that Margot Robbie put it up and just did it on her own, and then the studio was like, okay, we can roll with this because they saw the people, you know, kind of flocking to it. And I feel like Margot Robbie was trying to drum up interest. I could be reading into it completely, and that's my own thought. I thought it worked, though.
Yeah, I mean, it does have sort of the vibe of something that was produced on, like, a simple home editing thing. But at the same time, I bet it is, like, their release. It's, I don't know, but yeah, I could see it's like they just filmed behind the scenes while shooting or something.
I'm going to see this. I think Margot Robbie was probably the best thing to come out of the Suicide Squad movie. She portrays Harley Quinn very well.
Yeah. It ended up being an interpretation that was retrograde by having her, you know, reinstating as like canonical, like her in a loving relationship with the Joker.
Yeah.
How weird is it to have two versions of a property where these a couple, one where they're a healthy but weird couple, and one where they're an abusive couple? Like, you can pick and choose.
Yeah. Well, I think
This is actually called the Emancipation of Harley Quinn.
Yeah, I'm going to guess in the very first few minutes that she's going to do something to the Joker and they're going to be Splitsville.
Yeah,
which is great. They should be.
Yeah.
And she'll go off and form her own band of kick-ass women and do her own thing. I think this is actually directed by a woman. I forget who the director is. But I don't know. There's a lot that I'm excited for, especially with Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
I mean, I'm always open to the possibilities on the DC movies.
Worked with Aquaman.
I think this one has... I'm more concerned about than Aquaman, just because I feel like the creative team is less known. The premise seems more jumbled.
I'm trying to figure out who's directing it.
As you all know, I have no opinions on DC movies.
you have an opinion, Randy. It's just singular opinion. Burning hatred.
No, it's gone beyond hatred. I don't care anymore.
Are you going to see Aquaman?
No. If it comes... Whenever it comes to HBO, I might watch it, but I'm not in any hurry.
Yeah.
What I needed was a flood, no pun intended, of good buzz, and what I got was what I get from every DC movie, which is a mixture of people hating it, people loving it, and people saying it was okay. And I'm like, okay, when that is the spread, I usually know where I'm going to fall, and therefore it's not worth wasting my time on it.
Fair enough.
So, not for me. Not saying it's a bad movie, just saying apparently DC is not making movies for me. I don't expect Birds of Prey to be any different. But I don't think this is any... I think Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn is actually one of the stronger things they've got. I understand trying to focus around it. I do feel like it's weird, but it also makes sense. Like, it's a weird premise.
Well, it makes sense in that she has emerged as a star in the same way that, you know, the Arrowverse, because it was a surprise success, ended up as the hub of that became the wheel of all the CW shows.
Right. It was weird that Green Arrow be your Batman.
But, yeah, you know, it's like you go where the audiences go, and they flocked around her Harley Quinn pretty well. She's wearing something in this that has, like, it's some kind of jacket or something like that has, like, what looks like pom-pom sort of glittery things on the arms. And I feel like I can already just say that is going to be next Halloween's big cosplay and just cosplay in general.
So the director is Kathy Yan, which is, she's only done one other movie called Dead Pigs, which I have not heard of nor seen.
Dead Pigs.
But it sort of feels kind of like the Spider-Man Homecoming kind of person who did Cop Car. Yeah. Went on to do that. So this could be a breakout for her.
All right, the next story is weird. Not like all the others. It's about Starship Troopers.
Yep.
The 1997 movie.
Yep.
Starring Casper Van Dien.
Right. Do you know it was the movie that had Blur's Song Number 2?
Yep.
And the ads, and looked like a big crazy party fest of fighting aliens and good times, but then turned out to be Verhoeven's RoboCop-esque sort of subversive, gleefully violent...
Fascistic.
anti-fascistic, but with fascist imagery.
Yeah.
Movie that was too subtle to fully get that across to people. even though, like, Doogie Howser is a Nazi at the end.
Yep. Neil Patrick Harris.
Psychic Nazi.
Yeah, psychic Nazi.
Awesome.
But it was a one-shot movie. I guess it did spin off into some animated series.
Screenwriter Ed Neumeier, who revealed the news in a recent interview, wrote the screenplay for all three of the live-action movies. So apparently there were two more direct-to-video.
Yes, I remember this. I think it was a get when in the third one they got Casper Van Dien back.
And then an animated Starship Troopers Traitor of Mars... And apparently in the interview he said, I don't want to jinx anything, but we were talking about trying to do a television show based on that idea, the idea of a reboot with the original cast involved.
Say reboot?
Reboot.
Huh.
I don't think this is a good idea
The cast
all.
Wasn't really what made that movie.
No, it wasn't.
The cast is fun in the movie, and like arguably Neil Patrick Harris was a kind of a big part of that.
I bet Neil Patrick Harris wouldn't be in it.
But I think what people would want, what I would want out of it, and what interested me about this idea, mm-hmm. would be a continuation of it where they jump the timeline ahead and we see what these people have been doing, and you have a show that is a mixture of kind of dark satire and action.
Yeah.
I'm going to be go a little crazy here and say what made it good was Paul Verhoeven.
I agree.
It is.
His unique... bonkers and insane sanity was what made it.
His unique brand of madness, yeah.
He
can have can pull off a script that has things like it's some kind of brain bug God, there's a million lines that could have come off awful, but like people like Clancy Brown delivered them.
Brown, Jake Busey, the guy Jester from Top Gun.
Yeah,
he was also in Total Recall. Would you be on board to see a reboot?
Now that I know it's a reboot, I'm much less interested.
Yeah,
yeah. If that's actually what he says, like, and I don't even get that. I wonder if he was using the word reboot meant he was like. Rebooting the franchise,
they use the phrase remake later in the story. I think they're talking about a remake.
It actually just doesn't make sense, like to have those people like would like the guy Casper Van Dien just play like
those would be the parents that would
like, right
on.
Or he'd be like the drill instructor or something now.
God, I hate it.
No,
that's a bad idea.
That holds no interest to me.
Yeah.
But if it was a continuation, then I would be on board.
Yeah.
What if it's a shot for shot remake?
Sure.
But for TV.
But
like
for TV.
Gus Van Sant's Psycho?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, exactly
like that.
Like that.
But with
also Bugs. Starring Vince Vaughn.
Starring the Bergs.
Yeah. All right. Final bit of weird news. Blumhouse is going to take a shot at this dark universe of Universal Movie Monsters again.
So for those who don't remember that, they were taking all the old Universal monsters like
Mummy,
Wolfman, Dracula, Frankenstein, and they were going to try and do a shared universe series of movies, and... wasn't at one point the like Dracula Untold or whatever that one was?
That was the start.
That was meant to be the start, but like it didn't do well, so they're like, yeah, that wasn't the start. This Mummy movie is the start.
Yeah.
And then that didn't come off well, the Tom Cruise Mummy movie, not the 90s Mummy movie.
Yep.
And,
there were elements of that.
But here's
Mummy
the thing,
movie.
Like, I think a lot of people thought if it comes off, it's a neat idea, the shared monster series. Arguably, that the old Universal Monsters were the first time that a franchise like that actually did do that, because they did do Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman
right.
and stuff like that back in the day. They didn't have a big game plan, but they did do those movies.
They were just like, what if this happened and it would be cool?
Right. They're like, what if it happened, like, a Marvel Cinematic Universe? That's the goal for everybody. Blumhouse has a strong, you know, they have a value as a as horror. They're, like, the voice of horror right now. I'm trying to think, did they... They didn't put out, like, Hereditary, did they?
No, I don't think
so. Okay, I was thinking that... But, like, Get Out would be their big serious one. Insidious would be their, like, big cred one. And, you know, they've got just a ton of others from, like, sort of teen horror movies to, just, like, the Conjuring series. That's another one of their, like, all, you know, big stars.
They are the biggest name in horror that we've got.
Well, so Blumhouse, is it... It sounds like Universal and Blumhouse are also somehow involved in Halloween and Split and Glass.
They absolutely were, did produce Glass. And so, I guess the new Halloween. So yeah, they're like, they have a, I mean, they make movies that are not big hits sometimes, but they make a lot of stuff that comes off well.
So here's an interesting thing, another twist on this, that the first they've announced, they say that there's others in development, but the first they've announced, is The Invisible Man, by writer-director, Lee Whannell.
Okay.
Who wrote and directed...
I recognize him from the Insidious movies.
He did Insidious Chapter 3, and he wrote and directed Upgrade.
Okay. For those that... Yeah, the Upgrade was a kind of cool movie in the last year.
I like that one.
Sort of a cyberpunky thing.
Yeah.
He wrote all the Insidious ones, right? Is that what that...
I believe he co-wrote, yeah.
And is he the one who was also the star? He's one of the... He's like one of the two ghost... Hunter dudes in it.
He also wrote all the Saw movies.
Well, that's a little bit more of a downturn. But the first one's good. I think they just kind of leaned into the torture porny stuff afterwards, unfortunately.
But anyway, he's got some horror cred.
Yeah. I feel like...
I think if they can execute it well,
I could actually see this being the Hail Mary that is a success. I could also see it going wrong, but I actually think it will... I think it'll at least be solid, if I had to guess, just based on their track record. Whether they could, but pulling together a shared universe, it's tricky.
Yeah.
I'd like to see it. I think almost everybody I talked to, like, thinks the idea could be neat.
Yeah, I liked the idea, it's just the movies were all supposed to be bad.
And there were actually, like, the bits and pieces that were fun in the mummy thing.
I loved Russell Crowe as Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, was he the one who was, like, essentially the head of their Nick Fury?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
That was a cool idea.
In a way, it's too bad to lose that, because he was cool. The revelation of this, like, secret society that's been, you know, kind of, like, trying to rein in monsters over the years is a cool one.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wish them luck.
Yep. All right, that's all the news we have this week. We'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about comics.
One familiar cry.
We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, January 30th, and Dave, why don't you kick us off here?
Sure. People will note a thematic through line in my picks, but I'm going to start with a one-shot that Peter David did for IDW, which is a Star Trek The Next Generation comic. It's like a special for IDW's what they call their 2020 event. Essentially, they're taking all their big licensed properties, which ranges from kiddie stuff like My Little Pony to like Ghostbusters and Ninja Turtles, and for the
hologram
Gem. I know that Anna said she really liked the Gem one.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, for their 20th anniversary of IDW, they're taking these licensed properties and either projecting forward to have some vision of the characters 20 years from now, or jumping to 20 years in the past to tell some lost tale. And that's what this one is. Breaking out class, like, Peter David, who's, like, one of the most well-known Star Trek novelists, and who's written his share of the comics before, teams up with J.K. Woodward, the photorealistic painter, who did all the Star Trek Mirror Universe stuff, or rather kicked it off.
The first mini, yeah.
And he also, before that, he did the Star Trek Next Generation Doctor Who comic, and he's clearly, he's got an affinity for the property, and he does write by it. This is a one-shot story that jumps back in the past to when Picard was captain of the Stargazer.
Mm-hmm.
Referenced in episodes where they would, like, talk about the Picard maneuver and that first battle with the Ferengi, when they thought they were going to be, like, a serious threat. because I think the deal was he had, like, in that first episode where you actually did see them, they did, like, some flashbacks or like recalled his time in on the ship.
They did like energy pain whips or something crazy.
So in this, you'll see a Picard who's still got a full head of hair. It's essentially it's about the first serious meeting between him and the first meeting between him and Beverly Crusher, who at the time is. Are they dating or they're engaged? She's engaged to Jack Crusher, who, as of the, you know, people who are longtime Trek fans will know in the first episode of Next Generation, essentially Picard sees her. I think the deal was that they had had, like, a romantic thing in the past, but she had ended up hooking up with this guy named Jack Crusher. And
so is that the case that they have had a romantic relationship?
Not in this. I think the idea is that that happens between this and Next Generation.
Okay.
Or if nothing else, he had a thing for her that was unrequited, maybe. But the deal is, she married Jack, and he died at some point. I think just dies in the line of duty. So that when she arrives on the Enterprise in the first episode of Star Trek Next Generation, there's a bit of awkwardness where he's like, oh, well, you know, my condolences on the loss of your husband and all that.
Right.
But at the same time, there's like, first spark of a little bit of romantic interest with him.
That's what confused me here is because I thought that they were meant to have had some kind of relationship and that this was her coming on board the ship, the Stargazer, and that she had met him before.
I mean, they make pretty clear he's meeting her for the first time.
Yeah, but this, what's so weird to me is that there's no way he could have had a romantic thing because they're together. Like, Crusher is already with her.
Right, that's why I think maybe, you know, I don't have a strong memory of the specifics
they
from
tweaked it a little bit,
Encounter
maybe?
At Farpoint. I don't think so. I actually think it may have just been knew you and I kind of had there was a little spark between us, that was unrequited. But you were with Jack. I think it actually could have even happened into their relationship. Like in some later episode, he would say, like, I wanted to, you know, be with you, but you seemed happy with Jack. And,
right.
I think she was until he died.
Yeah.
So this is a story of Picard in his earliest days as a captain when he's both kind of a little unsure of himself, but and it manifests by him being kind of very brusque. I think this is a reflection of how in the first episode of Next Generation, when they kind of didn't quite have a handle on his character, he was especially prickly in that one. He's like, I don't like children on the bridge and all of that stuff. And he was snappish about it in a way that they would tone down later.
But let me say,
yeah?
I agree. Children don't belong on the bridge.
You know, Wesley has saved their bacon many a time with his stripy shirt of awesomeness. Jack Crusher is his first officer, and through kind of let's just call it a plot contrivance, he has to bring his fiancée on board the ship, and his hope is to actually just drop her off at, like, the academy, because she's I guess, a cadet at this point.
Yeah.
And the ship gets diverted, though, so she has to come along. Picard isn't wild about having her on board, and he's like, please, you know, stay in your fiancé's quarters and don't go about the ship wandering and causing trouble.
And no children on the bridge!
And no children on the bridge. Events conspire against them. They end up on this... There's a planet where I'm going to call it civil unrest.
Yes.
And a skeevy leader who Picard has to negotiate with. The leader happens to have a brother who wants to assassinate him. Indeed, while they're down there, something happens. There's violence.
Uh-huh.
Picard and Crusher both end up being involved in this. That is to say, Beverly Crusher. And what I liked about this is that Picard seems... I feel like Peter David always kind of gets the voices of the characters, and Picard seemed very canny here with his planning and his ability to kind of take control of a situation, even when he's, like, holding no cards. When he's first talking to the alien president, whatever they call him, he's telling him about his brother, and he's like, yes, my brother doesn't accept me as leader of the people. He's convinced I tampered with the election. And Picard is just like, did you?
That little beat panel where he's like, he denies it, but you can tell, okay, he probably did.
Right, he sort of smiles, and I think he's a little bit like, you know how these things are. You know?
One of the things that both Peter David and J.K. Woodward do so well is that there's little character moments in here that I think a lesser team couldn't have captured.
Yeah.
It feels like a lost episode of Next Gen.
Right. And it also, because J.K. Woodward's art is so good, this captures that era back at the tail end of the maroon uniforms that people will recognize as having appeared in Wrath of Khan and being used onward for that crew. But this is back when Picard still had it. And, like, man, he paints all that stuff so well and the ship so well that it'll make you put you in the mind of an episode. There's both it's not like at all the jokey Peter David, but there is some slyness in here. There's an interesting I like his first sort of connection with Crusher, but I think what I liked most about it was actually that Picard the way they portrayed his kind of intellect and his ability to, like, again, to take control of a situation. Anyway, it's just a one-shot, so you should just pick it up. You don't need to know anything about it. It's just called Star Trek Next Generation, IDW 2020.
Remind me, Peter David has done quite a bit with Star Trek, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Did some novels.
So he did the comics, and he's written... I bet there's at least a dozen novels. He specifically wrote a series that was set... that was called Star Trek Next Generation, like The New Voyages or something like that, where he created an original crew... But it also took a few characters, like, oh man, I'm trying to remember who all it was. There was a few characters who had been supporting characters on the show back in the day. I'll blank on it, but I'll look it up while we're talking. But, like, one or two notable actors portrayed some of these people in guest roles. Anyway, they end up on their own ship out kind of in this dangerous sector of space where he can kind of do his own things and not have to worry about them being so close to Starfleet that the characters can't kind of be a little bit more Maverick and a little more Firefly in their decisions. Who's up next?
Nick, what you got?
I have Action Comics 1007. Which I have not been...
Do you have to read the first 1006 issues first to make sense of this?
No, only the first, 976.
Okay. There's
10 issues
there.
Yeah, 10 issues that just don't even matter.
But make sure and start with Action Comics number 1.
Yeah.
No, actually, this is notably a start of a new storyline. So if you've been... Well, so here, I'm going to... Before you get going, Nick, Bendis's stuff, although I don't think it had particularly clicked for us, except for some of it for you.
Yeah.
I saw show up on a lot of year-end best lists.
Yeah, it resonated with a lot of people.
Right, and a lot of people, I saw a common thought that it took a while to get going, but Bendis' Superman run looks like it actually is going to have something to say and be pretty interesting. And
maybe
so
it won't be about Rogelzar.
Right. And so it seems like for people who missed that, or maybe who weren't feeling it, this might be one of those issues to turn them around.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting issue. Like I was going to say, I have not been super paying attention to his run on Action Comics or Superman, but I read an interview with him about this new story arc that he's starting, which is going to lead into a larger story at DC, like a big crossover. This story arc is called Leviathan Rising, which is in reference to Grant Morrison's Leviathan organization that he did in Batman Incorporated.
Right, which I don't think anybody has done much with.
No.
It's kind of, in a way, even though Grant Morrison is big, he has a lot of quirky stuff that other people don't touch, so it seems Bendis is kind of dusting off one of those ones.
Yeah, and I think Grant would be pretty happy with that. He likes people playing with his toys, and he likes playing with the other toys in the toy box. So, but yeah, this book is really kind of separated into three different stories. One focusing on Jimmy Olsen as he sort of stumbles into a Cobra rally.
That's Cobra with a K, the cultist organization in D.C.
Yes.
I skimmed just the beginning, and I thought that was kind of interesting, where he's out on a date with somebody, and she's like, You're open-minded, Jimmy. You're not going to prejudge it.
Let me tell you something that's going to change your mind.
Right, and so they walk into what looks like it could be like a club or something like that, and it's like a giant cult meeting for the Cobra organization.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. Jimmy is completely Jimmy, which I was happy to see. He's kind of fumbling his way through a bit.
Right. Is he actually holding out his camera there?
Yeah, he's trying to record everything.
Right.
And then something, of course... bigger happens, and we're led into a kind of the second part of the story, which is a meeting between Lois Lane and her father, General, what is his
General
name?
Lane?
Yeah, General Lane. I forget his first name. And sort of her revealing some things about her life that she's never told him before because they're so estranged.
Uh-huh.
And the conversation might be Bendis at his sort of top tier, where there's a lot of heart driven into both of these characters, right. And the conversation is very believable and heartfelt. But ultimately, it goes in kind of a place I wasn't expecting.
Okay.
So I was kind of happy with that.
Where is it?
I'm not going to tell you. You have to read the book. And the third one
is north.
The third one is about a Superman who is trying to save people from something that's happening in Metropolis, or actually Atlanta, Georgia. And weirdly, he hears a scream that he of a person's voice that he knows, and it's Amanda Waller, and he catches her, and that kind of leads into another big event. So, I mean, this is going to be all like the different spy organizations of the DC Universe. So, Argus, DEO...
Is Checkmate still a thing? Or is it folded in Argus now?
I don't know if it got folded into Argus or not, but I wouldn't be surprised if Checkmate doesn't make an appearance.
Okay.
Whatever Waller is doing right now, whether she is still tasked with Task Force X. But this is sort of going to be kind of a combat between all the different organizations, with, I think, Leviathan being the ultimate villain. And whether that is still run by Talia al Ghul or if it's somebody else, who knows? But I thought it was a really interesting start to the story arc, and one I'll keep my eye on because it's a good story by Bendis, but it's beautifully rendered by kind of spy artist extraordinaire Steve Epting.
Yeah,
I mean, his run on Captain America with Ed Brubaker is fantastic.
Right. He drew the famous Winter Soldier storyline, which went on to make Marvel's best movie.
Yes, and seeing him... I don't know if I've ever seen him draw DC characters. I mean, I'm sure I
can't
somewhere.
Particularly.
But his rendering of Superman is great, but I really like his Jimmy. I mean, it's dead on, but it's just kind of fun. It's interesting to see Perry White. He just gives the Ollie characters kind of a
believability.
Yeah, and it kind of ties in with that spy thing. I mean, Bendis probably chose to work with him because of that angle.
I suspect so. By the way, what if the person pulling the strings turns out to be Rogel Czar? He's back.
That would be a little sad. But, you know.
I used to destroy planets, now I run spy ops.
Exactly. Randy, what do you got?
All right. I don't know that I've actually mentioned this book. I've been sort of digging it, but I think it's sort of fallen just outside my picks. But Man Without Fear number 5 comes out this week.
Uh-huh.
It is the wrap-up of the Man Without Fear miniseries, in which I might have picked, like, issue 1 or something.
I think you picked the first issue.
So, basically, this is Matt Murdock. He's been hit by a truck saving a kid, and sort of a callback to how he got his powers.
Yep.
And because of, like, all the beatings he's taken, he's, like, scarred and bruised, and the doctor's like, you may not walk again, and he's sort of fearful, and basically thinking about giving up being Daredevil. Since this is a Daredevil number 1 coming out in a couple weeks from Chip Zdarsky, we know that's not going to happen.
What if that's a completely different
Matt Murdock? Fake out. There's this weird, like, skeletal Daredevil that's, like, with red eyes. It is old, like, yellow costume hanging off of him that's, like, haunting him. And throughout this, he's had an issue. Each issue has sort of dealt with one thing. So the first issue was, like, Foggy. The later issue was all his loves, including the one from Wade's run.
Kirsten, the DA?
Yeah, Kirsten comes back and was basically going to take him back, and he sort of drives her away.
Does it include his wife?
Yep, Noah? She's in there as well.
Noah?
Like, all of the Daredevil stuff is mentioned in here.
Interesting.
The last issue had Kingpin. This issue is Matt reflecting on his failures, his villains, and his father, and his father teaching him how to handle fear and how to get back up after a beat down and that kind of thing. And it's basically how are you going to go back to being Daredevil? And it's all sort of character-based.
A lot of that sounds like quintessential Daredevil, too.
It's really good, and the artwork has been really good throughout. They have different artists. This is Danilo Bayruth, who I think was the first artist. So it's got this really cool style to it. I really like this series. I think it's going to be a good collection. Unfortunately, it was one of those weekly series, so we had to order it way before we knew it was going to sell, so we've been selling out of it early. But when the collection comes out, I would definitely point that towards people. And I'm looking forward to Daredevil number 1 when Chip Zdarsky picks up from here, see how he incorporates that.
Mm-hmm.
My backup pick is Amazing Spider-Man number 14. I have not been feeling Spencer Spider-Man for the most part. I feel like he mostly just kind of wants to write writing a villain book. And I still feel like that's true. Like, in this one, he writes Arcade, Kraven, the Lizard, which Dan Slott set up. Basically, Lizard now has his Lizard family, which is kind of weird. He has a family dinner with Mary Jane and Peter. It's very odd.
In a weird way, I kind of like it because they've done so much with the family drama, and it was usually his poor, long-suffering wife and kid.
Yep.
If somehow they have become lizards and they're a happy lizard family, I kind of like the evolution.
Well, no, they're an unhappy lizard family.
No.
The kid wants to go to school. The wife isn't sure about it. Yeah.
It's like, son, you have to mulch your scales today.
He's like, son, you can't go be amongst the people because I'm worried you're going to be turning into a murderous lizard.
Okay.
He also has Rhino here playing off the Miles Morales stuff where Rhino's sort of gone good. Not entirely good, but he's working against human traffickers, so he's like team up with Spidey.
Teaming up with Miles too.
And then Black Ant and Taskmaster are in here too. So there's a ton of villains in here. Chris Bacala does the art. It's very, very nice. It's actually pretty straightforward. Bacala can be hard to follow, but I actually think this is some of his best stuff. But really, what made this work for me is like a 3-page story of Aunt May.
Huh.
Aunt May lost her husband during Dan Slott's run. It was J.J. Jameson's father.
Yep.
And in this, she's like having dinner with his old business partner, who reveals that she's broke. His his inheritance didn't really work out. And May reveals that she's a whiz at online poker, which she picked up from her other ex, Nathan Lubensky, who was a poker addict. And it's sort of like, I think it's obviously Spencer sort of resetting things to where May is struggling again.
Right.
But also in a way that doesn't undercut how she's been sort of a cool, stronger character.
Right.
And she goes out and basically sort of rescues a homeless man from some jerks hassling him using a holographic projector that Peter gave her. And then starts talking to this guy. And I get the sense he may be somebody. He's talking about how he lost his life. This was a disguise. He's an ex-reporter. And I'm like, okay, so there's going to be a story there. But all of that was really interesting to me. All the Spider-Man stuff was less interesting. But I'm like, oh, I kind of want to see where they go with the Aunt May story. So for that Bacala artwork, I would definitely give that book a look.
When you say holographic projector, I assume she uses it the same way what's-his-name Quaid does in Total Recall.
Yes, she pulls a giant head
running around. No, not that. The hologram projector where he's running around shooting people.
Oh, right, yeah.
While they go after his, what do you call it? Illusory double.
Nick, what's your back up?
I'm going to keep with the weird theme and choose a DC Universe 80-page giant entitled Mysteries of Love in Space. So what they don't say, it is about love and different characters of the DC Universe, space characters dealing with love, but it's also kind of melancholy in its approach in a lot of ways.
This isn't the a peppy, get this for your Valentine to leave him feeling great.
Right, no, this is not. It's kind of a look at some weirder tales of love. The first one being a apocalypse uprising, a woman who's working for kind of a rebel leader.
Yeah. I believe the people, I think those are the Hunger Dogs, the people, right?
I thought the Hunger Dogs were the giant dogs that Granny Goodness uses to munch on people.
No, the Hunger Dogs are the people.
Yeah, they're the resistance.
Ah, okay. So yes,
she gets captured during an uprising.
She gets captured, and it's sort of a long conversation between her and Granny Goodness as she is being tortured.
Yeah, as we should say, it's like Kirby torture. Like they're hooked up to a giant like pain wheel thing.
Yeah,
she's not like they're not like sticking knives in her and stuff.
It's called the penitence engine, Dave.
Of course. But yeah, it's
and there's a twist, of course, to the story. But
it is Granny Goodness is trying to like get her to turn over her boyfriend, another guy in the uprising, and so it is a test of her love and her faith and all that and her boyfriend. But yes, there's a weird dark twist to things.
But there's also a story about Kilowog, which I was kind of remarking with Dave that I have never seen Kilowog out of his Green Lantern uniform. So seeing him sort of in kind of...
He is wearing clothes.
Well, yeah, but seeing him in normal clothes, like everyday, like a shirt and jeans.
It's a little bit of a weird
sight.
Or
a jacket. It just is kind of odd, but yeah. I kind of like it. And it's him out on a date and him sort of being distracted by the Green Lantern life, essentially, as...
Is it like his phone keeps blowing up?
No, it's just
reports keep coming in.
He can't get out of that headspace. He feels like if he's not fully involved in like training these group of people, he can't separate
himself. He's married to the job.
He's married to the job. And he's sort of remarking on that. Guy Gardner makes an appearance, and I love it because it feels not like the hothead Guy Gardner from old. It sort of feels like the Guy Gardner from Green Lantern Corps that has been a little bit on the mend in some ways, where more of like a friend, and he's still hot-headed and everything, but he's more of a normal guy as opposed to
caricature version
of Guy. But it's, and Kilowog sort of finds a new recruit that kind of has a way of thinking like Guy Gardner. But it was a really kind of sad, but really well done story by all the art is fantastic, but this one is by Kyle Higgins, who's a known writer. I think it's all like new artists, and this one is Cyan Tormi.
They seem to be using this, they were doing those new talent showcases for a while. They seem to be using these 80 page for new talent.
I actually kind of like this better, where they do these theme stories.
Yeah, and then there's a Bizarro story that I thought was really touching. There's a Crush story from Teen Titans that has a...
A.K.A. because Crush, nobody knows Crush yet. Lobo's daughter.
Lobo's daughter.
Well, I thought you meant the turtle from Finding Nemo.
There's a Valentine's Day story with Hawk Girl teaming up with Starfire and... Is it Samantha Cruz? The Green Lantern?
Yeah.
And they're all kind of offbeat stories. And there's also... the final one is a story with between Lois and Clark. And about his glasses, which I thought was really well done. It's written by Jeff Loveness and art by Tom Grummet. And it was just kind of a loving, kind of happy story.
Okay. They managed to go out on a
really good note.
On a lighter note after beginning so dark with Dark Side stories.
Exactly. So I actually was surprised by this by quite a bit. There's even a Space Cabbie story on there if you want to get a little crazy. But... it's probably the best 80-page giant that I've seen in a while. Just the collection of stories and how most of them hit their mark.
Okay.
Dave?
And I continue my Star Trek theme. This is a week they put out two Star Trek books, and I really like both of them. This one is called Star Trek The Q Conflict. You might be shocked to learn it has Q in it.
Q from James Bond?
Yes, that's right.
I am shocked.
What's the actor's name who played Q?
John DeLancey.
John DeLancey. He was great.
Yeah, he was. In fact, when we were joking around about the possibility of like them doing in the style that they did of the 2009 Star Trek relaunch of doing that with Next Gen,
yeah.
We were trying to recast John DeLancey, and my suggestions were for like snarky and kind of slightly insufferable types were Russell Brand, Seth MacFarlane for the weird meta vote.
Yeah.
And, what was the one that Jose mentioned just today? He had some, I'll pull it up later, because I was like, oh, that's a pretty good one. Suggested Neil Patrick Harris.
I can see that. But here's what I'd say. Don't recast him. Only John Delancey should play Q.
He's
still young enough to play
Q. He's a hideously ancient man. but he is still great, I'm sure, at offering up the snark. So this one, this is, begins at least, I'll just quick stay, go ahead and say what the premise is. This is going to have all the captains fighting each other. Yep. That's why you're going to tune into this. Yep. But they actually set it up in a kind of a fun and interesting way.
Not just the captains, but the entire crew.
Right, the captains sort of, and their main bridge crew or whatever.
Although Enterprise isn't in here, right?
Not yet. We'll see if they show... I actually think they may not. I think they may have, for practical reasons, not have them. But knowing that it's written by Scott and David Tipton, who've written so many of these stories now, I wouldn't be shocked if there's some swerves in there where they bring in Enterprise crew. This cover, if I'm not mistaken, the dude on the top of the cover... Oh, no, I recognize... I see. At first I thought that was one of the captains. I think that's actually one of the guys that the Qs are warring with.
Yeah.
So, anyway... What happens is that the this is, I think, set post-Nemesis, or at least way, way down the line in the Star Trek Next Generation era.
Yeah,
because
they've got those uniforms.
Yeah, they've got the uniforms that you'll recognize from Nemesis. There's this all this weird stellar phenomenon, like stars going out before they should, or wavering and then suddenly coming back to life. And what they kind of ultimately find out is that this represents, this is the Q are at war with other godlike aliens, and you know Star Trek has had a lot of godlike aliens. Mm-hmm. And there's specific ones. I don't want to say who they are, but you're going to know every one of them.
Yeah,
I knew several, and I got the sense that all of them were like godlike aliens from the captains, who they various captains, and I thought that was really cool.
I feel like,
were they all, nobody was original, they were all from the
I feel Star like Trek? Maybe 90 to 100% of them are from the original series.
Okay. You would know better than me.
Yeah, because I recognize all the ones that they're from. Anyway, they these beings are warring with the Q, and like Picard, when he faces off with Q and he's like, you need to clean up your war or whatever, Q is like, oh, you think you're better than us? You think you could handle conflict or whatever? And it kind of sets the stage for this sort of contest of champions type mm-hmm. type scenario where the Qs go and they pluck the other captains out from out of time. There's a lot of really good dialogue in here and like dead on scenes for longtime readers, because they meet each other just briefly in this. This is like the gathering one.
Yeah.
So Tuvok, the Vulcan science officer from Voyager, who in a flashback episode of Voyager served under Captain Sulu.
Is that because Vulcans are so long-lived? Is that?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, also, Sulu was, I think, meant to... Yeah, it was meant to be in his past, but Sulu's probably meant to live a long time, too, because they just got better... You can age better in there. But, he is because he's so long-lived.
Yeah.
When he sees Captain Kirk and his crew, he's like looks and he's like, Captain Sulu? Like, they like look past Kirk at first.
Right, right.
And there's... I noticed that, like, when Q sees Sisko, he calls him, he's like, don't think I've forgotten you, Commander Sisko, my contentious compatriot. And everybody knows Sisko clocked him when they first met. There's a ton of great little bits in that throughout the whole thing. The premise is somewhat ridiculous, but you're not there to, like, analyze the premise on this. You're there to enjoy having all these crews meet to root for whoever your particular home team is. And there's actually a little bit more for the premise. They haven't fully outlined exactly how they'll be competing.
Right.
But it seems like in the next issue, like, there's almost going to be a drawing up teams thing.
Yeah.
And it may be that, like, people will end up picking from different eras. Like, this is, like, going to be, like, Star Trek volleyball pit team or, like, dodgeball.
Dave, don't you think this is the kind of thing they can only do in comics? Like,
yes,
like this is what Star Trek... One of the things that Whedon said back when he did the Buffy reboot, which turned out to be, unfortunately, a weakness, not a strength, but he was like, there's stuff we can do in the comics that we could never have done on the show. Like, we can't do a giant Dawn. We can't have Dawn turn into a centaur. We can't...
Buffy was flying.
Like, there's stuff you cannot do that you could do in comics. Yeah. Now, that turned out to be a detriment for Buffy.
But right, because it made it feel like it wasn't Buffy.
But for this feels like Star Trek with Q and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, there's no way they could do this.
Right, it'd be impossible because, like, it's the actors from the original series as they looked then, for one thing. A lot of those guys have passed away. And then, and of course, if not, they're old.
Yeah.
And that goes for really all of the original crew members. So bringing them all together is absolutely something that could only be done in comics. And I feel like this is going to be like a completely fan service comic, but like in the best sense of the word. Like, I feel like it's going to end up being well written. There may even be something to comment on the Q's warring style, but even if nothing else, I think just watching these characters interact should be a blast. So
I have to applaud David Messina.
The art's nice. The likenesses are good. That's a lot of likeness work.
Likeness work is what matters. Yeah. And
I mean,
if you could recognize everybody in all the panels.
Yeah, totally.
Four different crews. He's got to do four different crews. Yeah, I agree.
But
he does a good job.
I like the sort of the differences in their uniforms over the year. That gives them that hook.
Everybody is like kind of iconic in their way.
Yeah, I agree.
So anyway, that's those are the big ones.
Dan, what else is on your stack?
Let me see if I have anything else notable. I don't know if anybody here read this, but there's a new book from Dark Horse called Weird, spelled, which is a person's name in this, W-Y-R-D. He's like a special kind of like agent for hire for the government when they've got, it seems like sort of like supernatural cases and like stuff that's beyond them. It's honestly the kind of comic that Warren Ellis liked to do, and the protagonist is even a very Warren Ellis protagonist. So what was the book Warren Ellis was writing a few, no, more than this, like 6 or 8 years ago?
Fell,
but there was one after that that you read that I didn't follow. There was a series of, God, there was another series, I think.
Oh, Warren Ellis has 100 books.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
He never finishes any of them.
Anyway, if you're a Warren Ellis person, you might want to give that one a look. There's the concluding issue, Randy, to The Quantum Age.
Indeed, yep.
Which I realized as I was reading this, I'm like, I've forgotten a lot of what's going on and need to read the whole thing. But it is, I think, a fairly satisfying ending, which swerves in some directions I didn't expect.
Yeah.
So this is for all the Black Hammer followers out there. Quantum Age is, of course, worth a look when it gets traded, or finish out if you're still reading the single issues. Let's see, there's the finale of the Marvel Knights story. I actually ended up with some somewhat mixed feelings on this. This is the Marvel Knights by Donny Cates,
right,
that had a lot of their sort of street heroes and this really big mystery of that involved them losing their identities. And it had everyone from, like, Kingpin to... Do we want to say who the other bad person was?
No.
Okay. And some big reveals about what was going on.
Yeah.
I'm going to say I didn't love exactly how it ended, but it still had a lot of good moments in it and great scenes.
Yeah.
I think that is it for me.
Nick, what else is on your stack?
There was a Flash Annual number 2, which is kind of notable for a few reasons. One, it guest stars Impulse, which is sort of a prelude to his where he was before Young Justice appears. This also ties into Heroes in Crisis, because it's Iris finding out that Wally has died. And there's a lot about that in here. There's also a notable villain that returns if you've been reading Joshua Williamson's book.
Nick, am I correct that artist Scott Collins...
And yes, that is also the last notable thing is artist Scott Collins, who did...
He kicked,
probably
well, didn't kick off, but like the iconic portions of Jeff Johns's Flash run.
And he is back for that. The second issue of X-Force, which sees the team sort of team up with Kid Cable and kind of cause mayhem in a country that is killing off mutants.
Yep.
Remind me, are we calling him Kid Cable? Is that what his name
is
in the thing?
That's what they
call
him.
All right.
I think the story is solid. Ed Brisson's doing a good job. I really like Dylan Burnett's artwork.
The art is strange. It reminds me of like Adam Paulina's stuff.
It does.
It's got this weird stretch, but I like it. It's really good.
It just kind of gives it that kick that it needs.
Yeah.
Ta-Nehisi Coates kicks off a new story arc in Captain America called Captain of Nothing. It's a little downtrodden and kind of
sad. What if Captain America was sad?
Yeah, what if Captain America is sad? But Adam Kubert does an amazing job on the artwork, and there are moments in here that I think are really, really good. I like the notion of Alexander Lukin returning and sort of...
As the Russian general from Winter Soldier?
Yeah. And his wife.
I thought he was dead.
He's back.
There's a thing about it in there.
Yeah. So there's some interesting stuff here. I think Ta-Nehisi Coates is using some interesting storylines. I don't know if it's all going to work for me.
It feels like he's definitely riffing off the Brubaker cap.
Yes,
like
very much
so. He's skipping
so.
Over the other stuff and going back to what Brubaker was doing.
Yeah, where Spencer was sort of homaging a lot of the 80s Grunwald cap. Ta-Nehisi Coates is definitely doing the Brubaker kind of darker stuff.
Yeah, the espionage and...
Yeah, which doesn't... I don't know. I maybe just personally, I don't need to see that again. But,
but a lot of people like the Brubaker cap.
So there's definitely a room for it. And then finally, Heroes in Crisis number 5, which forwards the story. There's still some really interesting stuff in here with Mr. Gold and Blue Beetle. There's a wonderful speech by Superman that felt very much what Clark would say.
Always do the right thing, people.
Pretty much. there's the art in here by Clayman. Clayman is just uncomparable talent. I mean, he is just killing it. So that is about it for me.
Age of X-Men Alpha, which as I mentioned we won't have until later this week, but it kicks off a new alternate world, but it's going to be like a few linked books, and the notion is a world where everyone is a mutant. And it's clearly some, like, maybe Nate Gray has done it, but some kind of crazy thing where the world has changed, and it's an alternate world where everyone is a mutant and how people react to that. Journey into Unknown Worlds is another one of these 80th anniversary Marvel one-shots. This one is written by Cullen Bunn and Clay McLeod Chapman. It's got some really nice art. It's a couple of weird horror, like space horror stories. Like both of those. It's a good one-shot if you have an interest in that genre. Ms. Marvel 37, which is the penultimate issue of the long five-year run. We have a final issue next month. Punisher number 7 is more of Punisher in jail, dealing with a blind nun who runs the gangs inside this Begalia prison. It's weird and gritty and dark, and I'm kind of digging this Punisher in prison story, which is one of the good tropes. Punisher in prison always makes for good stories.
It does.
And then Skyward number 10, that book continues to be super weird, and it's about giant bugs and people trying to destroy the gravity freeze, and it's a weird sci-fi book. And the last thing I want to mention is there's a book from Lion Forge, it's a hardcover called To Drink and to Eat, Tastes and Tales from a French Kitchen by Guillaume Long. This is basically a chef who is also a food blogger and a cartoonist. And so he's got all these stories of cooking. So there's like one page that's a mini guide to recognizing fish, and it's got all the different types of fish. There's a page where he spends some time going to it's his journal from Budapest, where he goes to all these different places and talks about the service there and the food there and that kind of thing. And then he's got actual recipes where he does like an actual illustrated recipe of things that he makes. It looks really interesting. It looks like a
I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before.
Yeah, it's a combination of sort of cookbook,
biography,
biography. Yeah. It looks really interesting, and it's right up my alley, so I'm super looking forward to reading that. That's it for comics for us for the week. We'll be back to talk about, I don't know, a bunch of stuff we watched.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
All right, so we want to talk about the Fyre Festival, which this is probably a good time to announce. Rogues Gallery is an official sponsor of Fyre Festival 2020. On a private island, there was this guy. He came to us, and he's like, "Hey guys, would you want to get on the ground floor of the biggest thing ever?"
We're betting the farm on it.
Yeah, we got three loans on the store. Dave is taking a loan against his kidneys. We really think Fyre Festival 2020 is going to be huge.
Now, if you're like me, I barely remembered that Fyre Festival was a thing.
I didn't know of its existence until...
Did you guys not see... You guys saw the things going around, though, when it failed, right?
Barely remember that.
Oh my god.
When it was...
Let's just real quick back up. Like, just quick tell people, like, when was this?
This was last year.
It was actually... Okay, last year. Yeah, this is essentially about, like,
It's a guy named Billy
Venture
McFarland.
Capitalist, what would you call
he's
him?
He's a marketer. He's a con man, is what I'd call him, but...
Right, but that's not how he presents himself.
He's a con man for the rich.
Yep.
He basically was creating this thing called the Fyre Festival, which was going to be on this island of the Bahamas. It's got this massive music festival. All the hottest people were going to be there.
And they put together a great sizzle reel trailer, essentially, with... They actually did spend tons and tons of money, which nobody had the money to pay these people, ultimately.
And then all these dumb rich kids spent their money to fly down there and wound up in soaked tents with cheese sandwiches and no plans to get them out of there and no music.
Right. It went colossally wrong. There's lawsuits. People are in jail. People were like... There was at a certain point some of the people working there had to flee the island because people were like a contract killing. They're going to put out killers.
Yeah, people who actually lived on the island had to flee it because people were wanting money.
I don't know that you guys. I remember the Fyre Festival thing going because there was this whole thing. There were all these memes about these spoiled rich kids being stuck on the island. And
right, I caught the very tail end of that after it went wrong.
I had my head in the sand. I don't know.
I had the Schadenfreude of watching these spoiled rich kids suffer. Yeah. So and I was like, oh man, what a disaster! That's crazy. And then you guys both watched this documentary. And all my friends are talking about this documentary, and I'm like, I don't care about this. Like, I don't want to see any more of the Fyre Festival. What do I care?
Right.
And you guys both talked about, we're going to watch for the podcast. We're listening for the podcast. So I was like, okay, I'll watch it. And I watched it, and it's bonkers, and everyone should watch it.
It is very compelling.
Well, I will say there's two documentaries.
Yes, right. There's two.
But I feel like the Netflix one is the main one we're talking about here, and it's the only one Randy has seen. Yeah. The other one, Essentially, the guy who's at the center of it all is spoken of only in, like, discussed by his friends or former friends and co-workers and everything. He's actually interviewed in the Hulu. Is it Hulu?
Yes. Hulu is the...
Yeah, so that get, and there's additional insights in there and a different approach to it. Yeah. So there's definitely something to be said for both.
Yeah.
But I feel like if you're only going to see one, I think the Netflix one is the one to see.
Yeah.
But yeah, what it is like, so I was watching this. I'm a type B personality, which is like, so I am not like a big planner. But when I do plan something, I want it to come off. And as I was watching this, I was like, my skin was crawling at how badly planned it was. Mm-hmm. Like I was like. Because they were trying to put together this whole music festival that would take minimum of a year to get, like, all the infrastructure set up on this island and all this, like, as a baseline thing. They were going to try and do it in 6 months, and that's with, like, wild mismanagement, too.
Well, that was, like, people telling them, no, this can't be done. You've really got to focus on, you know, like, waste management for toilets and things like
that. Right, they weren't even thinking of, like, basic concert experience stuff.
And they got kicked off. They said they bought an island, and that, of course, was a lie. They got kicked off of the island that they had leased, and then they moved it, like, three other times until they finally got onto this weird... peninsula of a resort, of the sands.
When they do these flyover shots, it is a beautiful looking place with this amazing clear water and stuff like that. But there's like no hotel, no concert venue there. There's really nothing. The guy was really selling the idea more than anything else.
No, not just the guy. I think this doc. I think we all let everyone sort of focus things in on Billy McFarland, who is. A 27-year-old con man who deserves to be in jail.
Yeah.
And has been in jail.
Yeah.
And is ruined.
I'm going to say, like, not ruined enough or probably hasn't been in jail. Won't do enough jail.
But it's ruined enough. It's co-conspirator.
Everyone involved in this was stupid. Everyone involved. Even the older guy who I think is a very entertaining personality. Everyone involved should have known better.
The older guy, his older gay friend, tells the most the craziest story in it as you get to the end. I don't even want to remotely hint at what it is.
We also should say that Ja Rule had a hand in this.
Oh man, Ja Rule does not come off well in this.
No, not at all.
What was it like? In a sequence that they're showing after things fell apart, and they're doing like a Skype meeting or whatever, he's like, somebody's like, well. We basically committed fraud, and Ja Rule is like, "No, no." He's like, "No, we didn't commit fraud. It's
false
like
advertising.
There was false advertising." Yeah.
Well, isn't it the Hulu one where he like gets drunk on a talk show?
Oh,
he actually
right when it like starts out,
it's like it was his idea.
Right, it's hilarious because they show like at the beginning of this, like he was like on some radio show or something like that, and he was like, "Yeah, I was just there really for support. I was kind of an idea man behind the scenes." And then by the end of it, he's like drunk and he's like, "Yeah, it was all me."
Yeah, I mean, he's literally just saying, "Yeah, it was my idea, and it was Billy and my idea, and blah blah blah." Yeah. And I'm just like. Yeah. I don't think Ja Rule saw any repercussions whatsoever, did he?
Oh, I think his image is definitely ruined.
Yeah, but...
I mean, he went on to do another thing.
Right, he may have made his money, though, like, and, like, not lost too big on this.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, because I think everyone...
He was essentially just lending his voice as support. I don't think he was, like, like a ton of contracts and things had his name on it. I don't think the buck will stop with him.
That's crazy.
What is interesting...
He was definitely heavily involved.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it wouldn't have come off and gotten so many investors if he hadn't been.
And that people are talking about, they're talking about changing the SEC rules, I think, or so they're changing rule, FCC rules about influencers on Instagram and all that stuff.
Right, all the Kendall Jenners of the world.
I watched this and I felt like there were no heroes because I'm like, I don't care about all these rich kids who got scammed out of their money. I don't care about all these people who did this. The people I felt bad for were the people on the island who worked night and day to try and build this stuff, and then got screwed.
Like,
and the woman who owns the resort, who basically was out the $50,000 they were supposed to pay her, and put out her own $50,000 in savings, so that basically she could stay on the island because she had to pay people who she owed money to.
Well, my wife did a little bit more digging on that because she was interested, and I guess somebody set up a GoFundMe for her.
I was going to mention that. There's a GoFundMe that set up for her that raised $200,000, so she's gotten her money back. And she's going to spread that money around to the other people on the island, all the people the laborers who tried to build the thing and that kind of thing. So basically, the real victims of this are getting their money back.
Yeah.
The people who got screwed are the people like the money people, the venture capitalists who Billy McFarland, and that's why he went to jail, because you can't screw over rich people, because that's what happens. And so ultimately, I watched all this, and I'm like, okay, this is crazy, but I was not emotionally involved in it because I'm like, yeah, this is a bunch of rich people screwing over other rich people.
Right, but there's also, I feel like the story of a malignant narcissist at the whose promises destroy the lives of everyone around him.
Yeah. There could be
lessons for us there.
Yep.
You know what happened to that guy? He went away in chains and went to jail.
Yeah.
If only that could happen in the other story. I was gonna say one of the things that made this a compelling documentary, as they're showing it throughout, they also intercut scenes of the various PR reels they do,
yeah.
Which is all these like sexy models and stuff like that, and they're swimming,
yep.
And it's the characters like Billy McFarlane and Ja Rule and stuff like that, smoking cigars and drinking champagne and partying, spending tons of money for promo videos and scouting trips and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they're having a great time, and clearly just ignoring ignoring or kind of wishing away the the terrible things to come.
Yeah.
As they said, at some point there was like some meeting that was like, things are going really bad. We're like 2 days away from the show, and like Billy, they said, would like just go out and like jet ski to clear his head and stuff.
No, what he was clearly doing was going out to do cocaine because he would come back amped up.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Or come back with a lot of $5 million in his pocket.
It was fascinating that the guy had apparently this like, he won't anymore, but he had like an amazing ability to like scam people out of money.
Yeah,
I think by talking a good game.
That was my takeaway.
It seemed like everybody who was, if you sat in a room with him, by almost all accounts, you would think, this guy knows how to make money. This guy is going to make stuff happen.
Yeah, it's almost like a con man can sell people on anything against their own interests and then rise to greatness and suffer almost no consequences.
Yep.
But that can't be true. the takeaway I had from this was definitely that that Billy McFarlane, like, looking at all the marketing they did, like, everybody that worked on it, can you imagine if they'd had a product?
Yeah,
like their marketing was amazing. Like they got all this attention,
so much so that they were like, even like they were about to like, if this had gone through, change the way things are done for promoting events and stuff.
If they had had a product to go with all their marketing,
right,
this would have been great. But they were guys. All they had was the ability to sell something, and they didn't have anything to sell. That's one of the bigger tragedies too. Is like, you guys actually did your jobs. It's just that nobody was doing the other half of the job that was really crucial.
Right.
Well, this also touches on his previous scam, the Magnesis. The
Magnesis credit card. Credit card from millennials. God, this made me want... This made me hate humanity so much. I wanted to burn the whole world down at the end of this thing.
I don't think I felt quite that way. I don't know if Randy is selling it on people wanting to see this.
No, but that's what I'm saying. I could enjoy it because I didn't feel sympathy for anybody. So... I could find it amusing in it, whereas I think if I was watching this and I really was like feeling for all these people, I would have been horrified.
I think I'm very happy to see this kind of hit the masses, because I think there are lessons, just general lessons for us to learn from
the rich.
Well, I mean,
people are also very credulous. It is easy to buy into things.
Yeah.
Arguably, the leadership of our country is proof of that, and a general like. Critical thinking is something that we should all practice, and like I think a lot of people would agree that there probably should be some kind of course taught in school or something like that to get kids thinking critically about how advertisers target them. Like, I was watching this over at my girlfriend's place, and we watched the second one, the Hulu one, with her 10-year-old daughter watching parts of it, and we were kind of trying to explain to her what's going on, and she did get, she understood most of it. But occasionally when we would talk about, like, the influencers and stuff like that, she understands Instagram, of course.
Yeah.
Kids are smart. And she spoke of them with, like, an almost, like, an awe. Like, she's like, yeah, like, an influencer can just say, I wear this lipstick, and then the next day, 10 million people buy it. I'm like, that's true. But she was sort of saying it, like, in an awe way. And I do think that kids can watch that stuff and think, that's what I want to be.
Uh-huh.
The person who can do that.
Yeah.
And I think there is, like... I hope there's some blowback against giving anybody that kind of power.
Or we should burn Instagram and YouTube both to the ground. But I say this as someone who has an 11-year-old son and sees enough YouTube that I think we should burn YouTube to the ground.
Can we burn Twitter down?
Yeah, Twitter should definitely go with it.
I need a place to watch epic rap battles of history.
That's what Facebook is for.
It's on YouTube, though.
Oh, right. Facebook, we should burn that, too. Anyway, let's turn off the internet and go back to Luddite ways.
Sure, that sounds great.
It's going to be hard to get the podcast out.
Should we just, I don't know if we were going to mention this, but speaking of Luddites, we should say that the second episode of Star Trek Discovery Season 2 was really good.
It was excellent, yeah. It was very classic Star Trek in a lot of ways.
Yeah, a relatively Discovery. Standalone episode. It advanced the larger plot and revealed some stuff, but yeah, very much a classic episode and very much leaned into their what's going to be, we know there's going to be the theme of the season of science and tested by faith. Yeah. And their relationship with each other.
And wonderful character moments for Tilly.
Yeah. Rogue Squadron Management recommends Star Trek Discovery.
Yes.
And Young Justice. Watch that, too.
Oh, and Young Justice, which is great. Although Dave hasn't watched it.
Yep. But I recommend it, too.
Yes. all right. You guys want to talk about Glass, not the concept of the movie.
So people saw and liked Unbreakable. Some of them saw Split, and a lot of them didn't know it was a stealth sequel.
Wonderfully surprised.
Yep.
And opinions were split on Split. Some people did not like it.
True.
But we all liked it.
We all liked it. Most of the people I know liked it, and anybody who didn't like it can go to hell. I think the one legit criticism I heard or that resonated with me was like his treatment of the sort of mental health.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the complaint I've heard. That I'm like, I get that.
It falls in line with the with movies like I would say like Psycho, where the science, even more so than Psycho, this is kind of like a fictional suspense movie setting, and they are using they are using it
it's
plot device.
It's comic-y, larger than life, even though it is supposed to be sort of grounded in the real world. There are concepts sort of battling
each
other.
So there's three big characters that were introduced over the course of these movies. Bruce Willis, of course, in Unbreakable, as David Dunn, this guy who finds out he has this strength and invulnerability of sorts. I think we can say who Mr. Glass is by the end of it. Sam Jackson has been revealed as this treacherous mastermind type of
Lex
character.
Lex Luthor kind of type. Mm-hmm.
With
brittle glassy bones. And then a wild card was introduced in Split, where you had this guy with DID, as they call it now, whether you're calling it multiple personalities or dissociative identity disorder. I don't know. I'm sure the Crumb is a reference.
Kevin Crumb.
Where he's a dangerous, criminal-minded, kidnapping...
has, 30-something personalities. Yeah. And the personalities actually resolve in sort of kind of a David Haller-esque way, where they sort of form a tribunal in kind of ways and, form factions. And they have kind of...
Who is allowed to appear is,
And they've
under
created
control.
This personality called the Beast, which is kind of like a... animalistic
It was the predatory creature that you saw at the end of Split, who was like bending iron bars and taking shotgun blasts to right almost at point blank. So in this, I have to say one of the things I most wanted out of this was that the story stay small and sort of true to the vision that he was doing. And he absolutely, Shyamalan does do that. And so I have a few complaints about it, but I like that the vision stayed small and intimate and human.
The thing that I love right out of the gate was that David Dunn still has his relationship with his son.
Oh, yeah. Man, I cannot believe how much his grown son still looks like that kid, though.
I mean, it is.
I know.
Actor.
When I was watching it, the very first shot, something didn't look right, and I was like, oh, I guess that's the actor they cast as his son. But just a few seconds later, I was like, oh, my God, that's really the kid.
Yeah. And that they kept that, and that...
He does a really good job.
They really feel like they've got that father and son dynamic.
We want to say... I kind of want to say what's going on, because it's the one very comic book movie-ish kind of thing in it.
Yeah.
Is they are working together like essentially like Oracle and like Birds of Prey. They actually have a team. David Dunn owns like a little small securities company, and
they sell like hardware and things to businesses.
Like homes and businesses, security.
And then at night or during
he goes on
hours,
patrol.
He goes on patrol,
and his kid is like his backup on computer and talking to him through like a Bluetooth.
Yep.
And they they're trying to track down the Beast.
Yeah, the Beast is still running rampant. I think he's killed a few more people.
Yeah,
and David Dunn is trying to find him.
Yep. this movie also draws out some interesting supporting cast people who will be key, you know, all play important roles. I guess we should say, first of all, through a series of circumstances, these characters wind up at an institution, correct, like a psychiatric institution, and much of the movie takes place there.
Yep.
In some cases, I thought that was slightly to its detriment that so much time is spent there.
But we're introduced to a psychiatrist named, played by Sarah Paulson, which is a very layered, interesting character.
She has this deadline before the characters are going to be taken away and split up.
Basically, to try to figure, to tell them that they are imagining these things, that they don't actually.
Well, to get to the bottom of it, yeah. I guess. And then there's a few other supporting characters. David Dunn's mother, who, you know,
Mr.
Glass's mother, who, yeah, kept his hope alive, sort of through as a kid who suffered all these grievous injuries, memorably played in the first movie. She plays a role in it. David Dunn's son, as we've talked about, and the girl from Split, who's now grown up and is like in high school, or like looks
Split,
like a senior.
The Beast lets live because she is different,
right? And there is there's some resolution to sort of what was a hanging question in Split over like when you kind of like learn this dark secret about her past as to whether she was going to report it or not, or where it was going to go, and that does get resolution.
Like Unbreakable and Split, there are a lot of quiet moments, and then Glass has those too, and they're just really heartfelt kind of character moments, which I think kind of drive the story.
It's always interesting to see, and I don't want to quite these different characters, all of that we've mentioned. They sort of move around the map and interact with each other, sometimes together, sometimes separately, and almost all of it is pretty interesting to see.
I mean, Samuel Jackson is great at what he does here. I still think James McAvoy steals the entire show.
It's hard not to when you're essentially playing a multitude of characters.
Yeah, just his ability to give, I mean, honestly, a personality to 30-something people and all feel different, but all played by the same person, I just thought was exceptional.
There's a scene where she's talking to them, and, you know, one of the things that I thought was fascinating about Unbreakable and even Split is I would think about it and think, the stuff that they do is almost within the bounds of human possibility. Bruce Willis lifting, like, several hundred pounds, people can do that.
Yeah.
You know, you usually can't if you haven't worked out a lot.
I can. I can totally do it.
But Randy says he can.
I'm doing it right now.
And the Beast was like, oh, man, it seemed, like, beyond human. There was, like, he was, like, climbing walls and stuff like that. But what happens is there's a scene where the psychiatrist is kind of discussing those, and she throws out some interesting possibilities as to about how maybe this is actually kind of like not really happening. And I had always wanted that to be addressed, that it was like they were just within the normal human limits, or so it seemed. And the movie, that becomes kind of a big thing in it.
Yep.
I don't want to quite say how, but it's an interesting thing. And it's Shyamalan. There's a twist.
There's a twist.
I would say there's at least two or three in a way.
Yeah.
I accidentally spoiled myself on one of them before I saw the movie.
Oh, really?
I looked up something on Split, and I don't want to say what I was looking up, but I wanted to just recap the story in my head because I didn't have time to watch it, and I read the wiki on it, and there was one thing in there that I was like, huh, I don't really remember that. And it was clearly edited after this movie had come out to include that.
About.
Yep. And I was like, huh, I guess I just didn't remember that, but I guess that was a thing in Split. It was not, and it was revealed in this one. But anyway, a few times, Nick, you said you did not, but I did find myself a little bored a few times.
I was sort of invested in the characters, and that's kind of what I wanted. I'd read a bunch of reviews before, not like spoiler reviews, but it was universally getting panned by a lot of people. So I was kind of like, and everyone's like,
I think we would agree,
it drops the ball.
We definitely both agree, unfairly panned.
I think so. I most of them were like, oh, it's boring. It doesn't, you know, live up to what it needs to be. It's like,
I actually think, especially based on sort of where it ends and stuff, I think it did live up to it. And I actually, you know,
Shyamalan was watching it, like, and I was expecting it to drop the ball. At any point, I was like, okay, this is where it's going to suck, or it's going to swerve, and it's going to be completely different.
Right, or the characters won't feel right or something.
There were moments I was like, oh, if they do that, I can sort of see what reviewers are talking about. But I would never got to that place. I was like, oh, these are all cool moments. Mm-hmm. Oh, the action scene. Oh, this is really fun.
Yep.
This is well thought out. Oh, Bruce Willis is actually giving a shit about his performance. And
Bruce Willis actually, like, I feel like he's playing this quiet kind of man with no name-ish type guy who he was in the first movie, too.
Yeah.
But he's clearly visibly aged. And
there's a subplot with, like, his wife that I thought was really kind of poignant. Yes.
Yep.
So, I actually don't know why this is getting as panned as it is.
I think it has something to do with... Well, I will say this. Unbreakable and Split both had a strong suspense story hanging over them. There was like... It's literally almost like a killer on the loose, or can you escape from a killer's prison in Split?
Yeah.
This one was not quite that... It wasn't quite anything hanging over it like that.
Right, this didn't have sort of the normal confines of, like, what Unbreakable was, like, about hero awakening. This was sort of an Avengers everyone meeting. And...
Right, and so... And even then, it was unusual the way they met.
Randy, I know you've said you would not want to see it, but I think you would enjoy this based on what the things you've liked about Split.
I think
I'll
probably like it. I'm just not in any hurry to go out and see it right at the moment.
I can see that.
Not feeling it.
Yeah, be a little bit careful about the people who are more loose lipped about spoilers.
Yeah.
But yeah, the more I've thought about it, the more I'm really happy with where it ended up.
Yeah, I'm too.
And that was the biggest thing for me, is like I kind of wanted the meta story to work, and I feel like it did.
I agree.
All right. Okay, that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until such time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.